Hello, dear listeners. You have clicked on something that promises to be really, really interesting. This is Dialogia, or now that we are speaking in English, I think we should rename it Dialogy. Dialogia. It's a podcast about social science, social scientists, and the stuff that we study. I am Maria Muruma-Mengel. I am working as an associate professor of media studies at the University of Tartu, and I will be your host. We are entering our fourth season, and as with the previous three ones, we have a specific theme to it. This time, we will focus on disinformation and information disorders, info manipulations, and also I think we will be talking about info activism quite a bit. All of our guests will be somehow connected to this topic, and they will tell us about how these things work and hopefully also how to solve some of the problems that we are facing. Our first guest is Victor Wiart.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
Victor is a postdoctoral researcher in media and communication studies. His research interests include news production and reception online and on social media platforms. And he has been involved in multiple research projects which have studied the influence of algorithms and interfaces on opinion formation. Did I get it right, Victor? Is this what you do?
I think so, yes.
That was a really like a formal statement of that's our guest. But before we even talk about any of the stuff that you study and are involved in research, we have to agree on a safe word.
All right.
And a safe word is something that I will yell out or, you know, say very calmly, that whenever you start to talk in a manner that is too difficult or, you know, using very specific terminology and lingo and get all excited and, you know, very detailed about your research, then I will be the wet blanket and I will be like, no. I will say the word and then hopefully help our audience to double check something or rephrase something and be there. I will do my best to be there for our listeners who might not have spent the last, I don't know, 10 plus years studying disinformation. So what could be our safe word?
Well, how about douche?
Douche!
If it's just you and me, okay. You just tell me when I'm being a douche and I'll okay. Try to keep it simple. How does that sound?
It sounds really good because I think that there is no reason for us to use that word in a, like a normal way.
No. If you use it, I know why you're using
whoa.
And douche in French means shower, so it's not that bad to use that word.
Yep. Same. In Estonian, it's douche. But first, we probably approach this topic in a very everyday manner, like stuff that we see around us, what we read in the news, and that we find disturbing or helping and exhilarating. So what's the problem, Victor? Like, what is the topic, and where do we see things that are not okay?
That's a tough one, huh?
I know. I always begin with the most horrible questions.
Yeah. What we do know is that disinformation, because of social media and because of the internet, it has an impact. It has a big impact. We've seen how it can turn elections, how it can change the mind or the direction that entire communities take. So we know that it's a big problem. No, and that's part of my research, and maybe we'll get into that. It's not always a big problem, and it's not always useful to frame it as a big problem. Sometimes it's better to just go into details and see what it actually looks like, right? Disinformation, instead of kind of, you know, idealizing it and saying, okay, disinformation, it's a big problem.
And it's a really abstract one, because when you... Dear listeners, you can now like imagine what is disinformation and try to track what comes into your mind. For me, it's like this mess of words, and for some reason also the technological things and so on. So, but what is disinformation then? What do you focus on?
Well, yeah, disinformation is many things. As we've discussed, there's many ways to frame it. There's many typologies, and I think that it's the interesting way to frame it is that anything that circulates on the internet that is not information,
mm-hmm.
And that opens up the Pandora's box, right? Because in disinformation, then you have news satire, you have propaganda, you have false information, which is what people would actually call, you know, fake news. You mm-hmm. know, this false information. You have many things.
Trolling.
Trolling is disinformation.
Telling jokes
can be disinformation again if you mm-hmm. relate it to satire, propaganda, to news, mm-hmm. to current events. Then yes,
I think that many people think that disinformation is something that the bad ones do.
Yeah,
is it like? Am I getting close?
Not always. There is this very specific type of like false information that bad people do when you have the Russian trolls or you know the farms in China or in different mm-hmm. countries. That happens. That exists. But I think that it becomes more interesting when you take the problem or the issue in a broader sense, in a broader context. Because at least when I talk to my friends in Belgium, people don't come across those really like bad fake news on a day-to-day basis, and even if they do, they can kind of recognize it, right? And yet we still have a problem. We still feel that sometimes on social media, you know, you stay there for 2 hours, 3 hours, you see a lot of different stuff and crap, and you feel kind of mm-hmm. even sick sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a better way to frame disinformation. Yes, there is this false stuff, but there is also all this other stuff, the propaganda, the politically or ideologically charged news. I think, keeping a broad definition of what disinformation is, I think it's more interesting to understand how social media works.
Mm. Because in this really popular holy trifecta of info disorders, disinfo is one type of harmful/false information, right?
Yeah.
And next to it we have...
So you have disinfo, which is harmful and intentional. Then you have misinformation, and then you have malinformation. One of them being unintentional, because sometimes you can share false information without being, you know, without meaning. Mm-hmm. It's just you're not doing it on purpose. And yeah, so the distinction, I think, between disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation is interesting. But again, myself, I like to look at the content, and I think looking at all the diversity of false content that is present online, the trolls, the propaganda, the mm-hmm. I think that's more interesting.
And it's very often talked abstractly in sense of the outcomes as well, like for example Brexit or Cambridge Analytica scandal and manipulating presidential elections. They tend to be these really, really big processes, but in terms of really micro level, like what kinds of harm can I experience because of disinfo or info disorders?
Well, first of all, you can have, even at the micro level, this can have huge impact. I mean, you know, the easy example is COVID, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It can have a huge impact. If you think that you can cure COVID by drinking this kind of drinks, or that can really make you sick, huh? And you can have real issue. But I think at the micro level, where it gets more complicated and more sneaky and more important is when it comes to democracy. Because slowly, disinformation and misinformation and all the weird content that you find online, I think if you're not taking a step back, if you're not discussing it with other people, this can slowly chip away at how you trust institutions, at mm-hmm. how you trust media, at how you trust democracy and others.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, others as well. I mean, at the micro level, that can really turn to, if you stay too long on Facebook and if you don't stand back, that can make you turn into a mean person. Yes.
And I'm bringing this to a very personal level. I hope you don't mind. Do you remember some kind of occasion or a longer process where you personally have been a victim or, you know, affected by disinfo or misinfo or malinfo?
I cannot remember one time where I've been affected, because by definition, I wouldn't know.
Yep.
I wouldn't know I've been the victim. But I know what I come in contact with on a day-to-day basis, and I really have to make this effort of stepping back, of discussing it with friends, with my partner, with everything. And on my media feed, because I'm, you know, 33 and friend with a lot of older people that are like 40, 50, 60, I think it has a lot to do with, I want to say, to put it bluntly, racist and sexist stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of like my uncles or like my friends' uncles and aunts who put stuff on Facebook. It's like, woman in the kitchen, you know, and like stupid memes and pictures and same
but
thing with
Victor,
Islam.
Victor, this is just for fun. Like, lighten up, baby.
No, but exactly. But again, at the micro level and like chipping away, I really think that if you see these kind of things every day and it gets into your subconscious, and then in the end it's like, maybe women do belong in the kitchen.
Yeah, perhaps indeed. Because so many people have told this in a million ways, in pictures and in words and in songs and everywhere, right?
If I saw it a million times, then it must be true, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in all seriousness, it's like, please, I have to tell myself, please step back. Mm-hmm. Be careful about this stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see that a lot on my feed with women and women's rights and like gender issues. I see that a lot on my feed in Brussels, in Belgium, where I come from. We have a big Muslim an Arabic speaking community. There is this issue with the veil, you know,
the niqab
and so on. There is a lot of posts on social media regarding that, and I always have to step back. But that's the good thing about being a university teacher, is that you're confronted with young people, with people who want to change the world. And so I'm really thankful that my students kind of keep me in the real world regarding these kind of issues. Yeah.
Do you find yourself saying, I have changed my mind on something often?
Yes and no. Because I don't want to be this guy that says A one day and B the next day and so on. But I realize as I get older that I'm kind of becoming a bit more conservative in a political sense. You know, like you have your first job, then your second job, then, you know, now I have to pay for a house and I have two kids. I have started paying the Belgian banks. They give you that like every month I give 50 euros towards my retirement plan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like pension plan. So I think that kind of makes me more conservative a bit every day. So I try to, again, as always.
And that's a very universal, like what you are describing. I think that most people who are of certain age, of course, because when you're 15, you don't relate. But the fact that you grow more conservative, you know, that has been a sociological phenomenon for decades and decades. But
I don't want to become too conservative.
Ah.
So I have to be careful. That's why I'm trying to be careful.
Okay.
And also, I think that might be a generational thing. I don't know. I might be talking out of my ass. But to be honest, I think that's when you might become ultra conservative and you have to be careful. I'm trying to be careful. Of course, evolving is okay and it's normal. Then older people want to be more safe and younger people want to be more adventurous, and that makes sense. I think that's universal, but you have to be careful not going too far.
In terms of comparing different countries, have you noticed any really, really sharp differences when seeing how disinfo and info disorders, and we will get to this, folk theories that you study more specifically, Do they differ in countries, or are we really similar?
I think there is a big, as you said, universal part. You know, we want to believe disinformation or disinformation circulate because the way social media is made, and social media is the same in every country. Yeah, there might be differences, but I mean, in Belgium and Estonia, you know, older people use Facebook, younger people use Instagram and TikTok, and that's basically the same everywhere. So there are some commonalities, some similarities. I think where you can find differences in disinformation circulation is when you see differences in the media ecosystem. Is there or isn't there in your ecosystem, I don't know, whether you come from France or Belgium or Estonia or Armenia or the US. For example, one question that you can ask yourself is there public media? Is it strong? Is it weak? Is it well financed or not? And I think that's where you can kind of see differences starting to take shape. And it's the same thing with the media ecosystem, and it's the same thing with the democratic system. So in countries, in some countries that have different democratic system or different level of trust toward the government, you will see different kind of processes of information circulation and disinformation circulation. I don't know. I'm trying not to be a douche, but I'm feeling myself slowly but surely using longer words.
No, and also we should be very transparent and give you a disclaimer. A disclaimer is that Victor has been talking about this topic for the whole day today, like for 4 hours. We've had seminars and public lectures and everything. So excuse us when we like float away in some moments or reference back like we were talking before, because I've managed to get Victor to the studio just like, no, you can't have dinner, we have to do the podcast as well. So we might drift off, but you are, dear listeners, you are really welcome to ask questions or clarifications either in the comments or later by emailing us, because we are old people and we use emails. Now, we will move on with your research topics. And before we get all nerdy and into the methods and everything, I ask you to explain your recent research or study like I'm a 10-year-old, because later on I'm going to take this short clip and play it to an actual 10-year-old and see what he makes of it. Like, does he understand what you're studying and what are his thoughts on that? So, Victor, the floor is yours.
So, not in 10-year-old terms, I'm doing audience research on disinformation in Belgium and Luxembourg. In 10-year-old terms, hopefully. So if you're listening to me, what I study is how people make sense of disinformation and of the news. So when it comes to news, to media, you might see TV show, you might see newspapers, all that stuff. You have some people who study how we understand them or how we don't understand them. This is the type of research that I do. So basically what I do, I go around and ask questions. It can be university students, it can be children, it can be teens, it can be older people. And I ask them questions about their media habits. For you, for example, I could ask you, what shows did you watch today? Did you like it? Why did you like it? What were the characters? These kind of questions. And after I ask a lot of people, I try and make some generalization. These types of shows are interesting because of this. These types of show are educational because of this. And that's the type of research I do.
Hi, Iko.
Hi.
So we just heard Victor talking about his topics. How did you like it? How was Victor as a speaker?
I feel like it was pretty easy to understand. There was not many like very complicated sentences and stuff, so yeah, like pretty good, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And also, did you understand what does Victor study as a researcher?
What I understood from the from here mm-hmm. was that Victor basically asks people why they like some sort of TV shows or newspapers, and like from a lot of people, so you could make like a generalization where you could see why people like it and why people don't like it. And that's what I understood.
That's what I understood as well. But can I ask you a personal question, Nico?
Sure.
That was a hesitant one. What kind of media is your favorite?
Me personally, I don't use like a lot of Snapchat, Facebook type, but I mean like, I guess YouTube as a platform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why should someone research this? Why is this important as a scientific topic? What do you think?
First of all, it's interesting for other people. And maybe because that we would know what to do better and what to not do to make people like the newspapers and other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Iko.
Thank you.
And now we enter the section of, I don't know, in Estonian we had the section was called Urib Purib.
That makes no sense to me.
Urib Purib is like a word, like a cute little wordplay on researchers and drills, like drills in the ground.
Okay.
But it doesn't make sense. So I think that we should rename it for this season, and we could have a section of the podcast called Nerd Out or something like this. Like, this is going to be a full nerd out, as much as this format allows us. So let's talk about the research. First, folk theories is something that you have today given a public lecture about, and yeah. you are doing this actively. What the hell is it? Like, what's the definition of a folk theory?
A folk theory is basically a theory of the folk, so a theory of the people. People have had theories for a long time before science, and even parallel to science, I want to say. And basically, the argument behind the audience researchers studying folk theories is that, well, we have to study how people theorize stuff. It's really, first of all, it's really interesting. But because we live in this super complex world, in this super complex environment, you know, with the internet, social media, information circulation, it's so complex that people have to make theories. And we have to understand them because they are, in essence, performative. They have an impact on how people live their life and on their everyday practices.
So first, I think we have to agree, what is theory?
Yeah. Theory is basically a generalized statement about the world,
mm-hmm.
right? The world works this way, or gravity works this way, or, you know. So a theory is a generalized statement about the world, a general view that helps you explain how the world works, mm-hmm. right? It can be just informative, this is how the world works, but it can also be predictive, this is how the world works, and that's why you should act in this way or that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's for theory in general. For folk theories, it's the same thing, but it's not made by scientists, it's made by people, made, constructed, you know, I'm using air mm-hmm. quotes, which you can't see, but in any case, folk theories are constructed by people and socially shared. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe after I can give you some examples so it becomes clearer.
But is it stereotypes? Like, are stereotypes folk theories?
They can be a theory, but the thing is that with the word theory, what we try to insist on is how people connect the dots. It's the connection. It's mm-hmm. I think this is how the world works, or this is how the internet works, or this is how Facebook works. because of this and because of that and because of that, and that's why the word theory is there, is we insist on the fact that it's constructed and that they are links that people make.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, to get more into practice, people have folk theories about algorithms and how the Facebook algorithm works, or the Instagram algorithm, or the algorithms of Instagram works, because there are more than one, right? Mm-hmm. You have a feed, you have stories, and so on and so on. Those are, first of all, those are proprietary, so we don't know the exact formula, and they're so complex that normal human beings like you and me, who are not, you know, specialists, don't know how they work. Yet, we use Instagram and Facebook every day, and so we have to develop some strategies, right, to be able to act, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we are having those theories. We construct those theories. It's kind of a natural thing to do. For example, you want to post something on Facebook. You don't know if you have to post in the morning or at night, on Monday or on Saturday, with a picture or with no picture, with a video or no video. What kind of text? Should it be long, short, easy to access or not? You know, mm-hmm. this kind
link
of
in comments or not?
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. This is so complex and complicated that you need to have a theory, right? And people quite naturally, actually, socially develop theories, you know, like
mm-hmm.
you have to post on Monday and it's better with the picture, and if you can, a video, and maybe ask a question mm-hmm. that will get you more comments. And so that's the basics, right?
But there is also empirical proof, because people often say that, because like, I posted similar things, but one went viral and the other one didn't. And then they try to understand what they did differently, which is like scientific thinking, right?
It is, it is. I mean, folk theories, that doesn't mean fake theory, uh-huh. or that doesn't mean that it's untrue.
So it's not a value judgment, right?
Yeah, not at all, mm-hmm. not at all. It doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means that it's different from a scientific theory. And in your example, it means that it's constructed based on personal experience, not based on peer review,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
basically. But personal experience isn't bad at all. Isn't bad at all. It can become bad. For example, if you think that you should post on Monday morning, you do that. But maybe 15 years from now, it's not going to work, right?
I'm going to be alone
yeah.
in the rejected and, you know, just like very quiet social media.
Yeah. If you hold it, this mm-hmm. theory too dearly and you don't accept to change your mind, then yes, maybe.
And in youth culture, that is really in like my studies an important thing that I often focus on. The young people who are using TikTok actively, they are doing a lot of this kind of like gut feeling directed algo tweaking, which means that they talk about their algorithm that they have worked on. They have put labor into this to make the algorithm relevant to them. So they are really careful about what they like, or like do double takes of, or watch several times to kind of reinforce to the algorithm that it's important. Or they have several accounts, one for animal content, the other one for things that they really find interesting or something like that.
Yeah.
So is this all folk theory?
Yes.
Ha!
Basically, yes.
Mm-hmm.
If they make it, you know, if they do this very consciously and it's based on their experience or something they've discussed with someone before, if they do it on purpose, yes, I think you could describe it as a folk theory and it would be interesting. But yeah, stemming not from this actual research, but from my previous research on algorithms, it's what they do. They most teens and older people too, but here you're talking about younger people mm-hmm. on TikTok, for example, they develop this very intuitive, very, I don't want to say primal, but very fast, quick tactics
mm-hmm.
to influence the algorithm. It's practices, but those are based on theories. So for example, you said, I want to change the algorithm so it shows me more interesting stuff or less
cat videos,
more or less cat video, more or less sports, more or less culture, more or less this and that, right? Well, they will say, for example, if I want more cats, I have, as you said, I have to like all the cats' video I see, I have to comment them, or I have to rewatch them over and over again so the algorithm knows that, you know, I like cat videos. Well, that's actually practice that's based on the folk theory. And then that's interesting if you go and ask those teens, but how long do you have to watch it, or how many times? Some will say 2 seconds, some will say 10 seconds, some will say, oh, 4 times, or some others will say 10 times, 20 times. Who knows? That's where it becomes interesting.
And it is correct, because it's it's impossible to get verification of these tactics from the platform, because that's business and that's none of our business.
First of all, it's secret. Yeah. Second of all, it changes over time. And third of all, again, you're only getting clues from other people.
Sure. So folk theories flourish in situations where there are information gaps or deliberate withholding of information. Then people are going to fill the gaps with their own theories, right? Like scraping together every bit and piece and then trying to make sense of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think they flourish when there is an information gap, and I also think they flourish a lot when things become more complex. And that's what we see with political information on social media. You have all these things. You have the different platforms. Those platforms have algorithms, right? You have different media outlets. You have different accounts from politicians and so on and so on. And it's so complex. It's like, why are you showing me this video? Sometimes it's clear. You have a friend who commented or something, or it's just sponsored. But sometimes it's not. And the more complex the issue becomes, I think the more likely you're going to have to develop a theory, because you're going to have to deal with it.
In your studies, have you actually like compared or checked whether folk theories are actually backed up by scientific or empirical data?
Yeah, I haven't checked, because that's not my role. Mm-hmm. I'm doing audience research. I'm only focusing on what people tell me. Mm-hmm. Try and make sense of that. I think that's already quite a lot. But what's funny, or what's... To me, it's funny.
But everybody's like, what?
No, it's not funny. But what's interesting is that, yeah, the big theories that I have found regarding disinformation and the link between disinformation and democracy, so what I call infodemocratic disorders, all of the main theories that I found relate to some kind of scientific theory or some of expert knowledge that we know of the world. So let me give you a few examples. So, for example, one theory is democracy deserves better than poor journalism. So we have a lot of people in our study that said, right now, journalism, mainstream media, it sucks for this and that reason, right? Mm-hmm. And democracy deserves better. Well, when you scrap and when you go into detail on how this folk theories are constructed, they really look like early 20th century critical studies on the media. You know, media are part of the capitalist system, and it's an industry, and it's just made to entertain you, and media sucks.
Yeah, media sucks. This is,
with my word, it's a scientific theory that's been developed over the 20th century. And so it really relates to this folk theory.
So folk theory and academic theory can actually be overlapping a lot.
Yes, of course. It's not opposite. It's a continuum. Huh? And again, you have some people who know nothing, even though I've very rarely encountered that in my research. Some people who know a little, some people who know a lot, and, you know, expertise is this continuum. And then, yeah, some people who are aware of the latest scientific discoveries on this phenomenon and that phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
And this is something that social scientists very often have to deal with, that our topics and our studies tend to be either really focusing on a really, really tiny detail in depth, or stating something that
is,
you know, everybody already knows that. But the whole point is that, yes, we had a hunch and a folk theory about it, but now we have hopefully scientifically proven fact.
But a lot of the stuff I do, it's quite obvious.
Of course. Yeah, but me too.
But yeah, but the only thing I'm trying to do, and I hope it helps, is to give context, is to add layer, is to make it more readable, it's to make it accessible. But that's it. I'm doing audience research. So I'm only telling what the audience tells me about this media mm-hmm. text or, you know.
What are some of the methods that you use? Like, how do you study that?
Yeah. Well, so I've been doing research for 10 years. I've tried a lot of different stuff, but I would say that my main area of expertise is qualitative research and its interviews. I've done all different types of interviews. You know, if you're into social sciences, you've heard the sacred word semi-structured interview.
Oh, semi-structured interviews.
It means nothing to me. No, but in all seriousness, it's supposed to be this middle ground between what open interview or whatever and closed questions. But having said that, you have said nothing, right? So I've tried a lot of different interview types. Something that I've developed that I called in-praxis interviews, for example. So
douche.
In-praxis interviews, in not douche terms, is just asking people questions while they are navigating on social media.
Ah.
So I'm not over their shoulders. I'm not trying to see if it's true or not. I'm not in their Facebook feed or mm-hmm. in their Insta feed or something. But instead of just have them talk about Instagram and give maybe stereotypes or big discourses about, you mm-hmm. know, how TikTok works, I have them on TikTok. I have mm-hmm. them on there, and that gives me a better context and I think more data.
So it's similar to walk-along interviews, which were done, like, for example, in urban planning and so yeah. on, where people walked and they showed researchers that this is not a safe place because, or like, I hate that street because,
yeah.
and then you could get a picture and not just like rely on memory.
It's walk-along interviews, walking along social media.
Yeah. Scroll along.
It's a scroll along interview. Yeah. I'm going to use that.
You have to put me in the acknowledgements. Like, thank you, Maria, for bringing this up.
I will. But it's exactly it. But it does the exact same thing as walk along interviews, which is giving you a more informed answer, I think.
Ethical nightmare, though.
Ethical nightmare. Yes.
How do you navigate that? Because you have to, you can stumble on some really personal and weird stuff.
That's the thing which I think differs from filming people actually being on social media and so on. Here I'm not watching them, so it's a lot easier. So it's just I'm interviewing you, you're on social media, I'm not watching what you do, I don't even care about what you do. We're just using that as a basis for discussion.
Okay.
So it's easier if you take it that way. I don't care that you like this page or this post or that post, or that you commented this or that, or that you activated this option or that option on your application. I don't care. I'm just using that as a basis on discussion. And again, because my end goal is not what you do, my end goal is how you theorize it and the link between the theories that you have and your practices. And we do the same thing. We did the same thing, at least in the beginning, with on this study on folk theories and infodemocratic disorders. But instead of having people navigating their feed on social media, we presented them with fake news, with fact checks, with regular news, just to see what they make of it. And again, we really don't care that they like this media or that media mm-hmm. better. What we care is like how they theorize. Okay, they see a fact check. Do they recognize it as a fact check? And then what's their theory behind it? Oh, fact-checking is bullshit because it's produced by mainstream media and mm-hmm. mainstream media is evil. That's a theory.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Now we are going to move on from the nerd stuff, but I don't know, we might continue with this because I would love to learn a little bit more about you as a person. So, for example, what kind of a kid were you? Were you a nerd?
No.
In all, like, love towards nerds,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. In all honesty, I think I was a normal kid. I was very active and very curious and very energetic. And I think one of my problems growing up was that this activity was described by some people as hyperactivity. And so they put me in that category, but I think I was a normal kid.
Mm, just like really lively.
Just really lively.
Did you talk a lot?
No, that started later on when I was a teen, let's say at 12. When I was a kid, I would fight a lot but not talk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Then yeah.
Who did you want to become? You know, everybody thinks about like some kind of options, or at least grown-ups tend to ask about it all the time. So, what did you give as an answer then?
So, when I was a teen, I really wanted to become a rock star.
And you are now.
Research.
Yeah.
I played the drums badly for a long time.
We need proof.
There are some pictures on the internet.
Yay!
I was in a few rock bands. Because for or it's a younger audience, there was a thing that was called rock music before rap and everything else took off.
No, that was cynical. Now I should say douche, yeah. Because that's like the young people know what the rock is. The rock, yeah.
No, mm-hmm. I'm making fun of myself.
Yeah,
here.
Of course.
So I was a drummer in a rock band, and so I really wanted to do that. And so I left Belgium when I was 17. With the idea that when I would come back, I would study to be a sound engineer and then I would be a rock star in the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
Changed my mind.
Why?
I don't know. Didn't play the drums for 1 year and then realized there was something else to life. And then also I realized I wasn't good.
Mm. Yeah.
And so when I turned 18, I applied and I went to this communication higher education institution. It's not a university in Brussels, but I studied communication in the hopes to become a journalist. And I really wanted to become a journalist until I discovered about research. And I realized, actually, I don't want to be a journalist. I want to do research on journalism. And that's what led me to all of this.
How did you find this topic? Was it a specific course or some kind of homework that sparked it, or like how?
You mean disinformation?
No, I mean that you want to become a journalist, or then the researcher about journalism.
Yeah. Well, I had this thing, this imaginary in my head of this like war correspondent. You know, I've always had this kind of a white knight in shiny armor kind of complex. Like, I needed to save the world. And the way I was going to save the world is becoming a war correspondent. I was going to have a big beard. I was going to have a scarf. I was going to, you know, sleep in tents next to whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Because that's a folk theory about what war correspondence means.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had this imagery, this theory about what war journalism is, and so I started studying communication to become that journalist. And everything changed actually in my third year of bachelor. I went on an Erasmus, you know, the exchange program, to Spain. And so that's where I shifted from what we call in Belgium higher education school. So it's not a university. It's supposed to be a bit easier, a bit smaller, you know, because I considered myself to be stupid. And so I was for a few months, I was in Spain, in Valencia, and in an actual university. And I realized, damn, I could do this.
Of course.
I could totally fake it until I make it, right?
Yeah.
So actually, when I got back from Spain, finished my bachelor there and switched to a French-speaking university in Brussels with the hope of becoming a researcher. So I started my master's degree then, hoping like, yeah, I'm going to do a PhD. And I at the time, I had other folk theories. I was like, oh, I'm going to do my PhD at Harvard or whatever. And like, I'm going to be this big researcher, you know. And I'm going to save the world, same complex, but from the safety of an office with a computer.
Why do you laugh at that? The Harvard dream and, you know, that kind of stuff.
For many reasons, I really changed in the sense that I'm not anymore pursuing this kind of. It's the same thing, yeah. Wanting to be a rock star drummer, wanting to be a star journalist, then wanting to be a star researcher. It's always, mm-hmm. And I've drifted from that a bit. I think not being a star researcher and being just a researcher is actually good enough.
It is.
I'm slowly starting to realize that. And even when I started doing research, I was like, oh, I'm doing research in Brussels, but I'm going to do research days and then I'm going to publish in the biggest journals and I'm going to do talks in front of thousands of people. But slowly but surely, especially when you get down to business and do the research, you're like, okay, maybe doing talks in front of 1,000 people is interesting to do it one time, but maybe that's not what I like. What I like is doing interviews and asking people about disinformation and this kind of stuff.
Have you had any meaningful connections whilst doing research that kind of stick with you, that you can't get out of your head, and then later on you're like, that's where something clicked or something changed? Can you think of anything like that?
Well, yes, I can think of at least one. It's my meeting with David Domingo, which you may know. David was my thesis supervisor. And I remember, so David's from Spain, teaching and doing research in Brussels, Belgium. And so I met him when I was starting my master's degree. And so I started my master's degree in communication and journalism. But I took this option, this course, to do research communication because I was like, I want to be a researcher. And so I took this class and I was alone. So my class was just going into David Domingo's office and prepare a fake scientific article. Fake it until you make it, right?
Yeah, quite literally.
And in the end, turns out I actually did a real research and a real paper which we published together like years later, and it's a small paper in a small journal, and but it doesn't matter because me and him have written a paper together. We've done more stuff since then, huh? But I was really feeling like a real researcher. Well, that's where it clicked for me. And to this day, I'm still trying to apply that in my research and in my teaching and with my colleagues. I make no difference whether it's your first year as a PhD student or whether you have tenure and you're the dean of whatever big fancy university. Same thing with my students. It doesn't matter if it's your first university course or if you're a seasoned student. He made me feel like a researcher, and I want to make other people feel like they're also that important.
That is so beautiful. It's so well said. I'm going to quote you now. But while we are already love bombing others, then who else would you like to kind of, you know, people that you have seen or read their texts and you're like, oh my God, you're amazing.
Well, for me, I'm a bad reader. You have to know that. I have, again, with this active personality, it's hard for me to sit down for a long time. So this is why I like dissemination, vulgarization so much. I like to watch videos and so on.
Oh, douche. What's dissemination, vulgarization?
It's when scientists use normal words. So not what I just did. But when scientists, when they will do a talk or a video or try and take this research that they have done or this paper, this report, and make it accessible to people, I love it. Mm-hmm. I can watch those videos forever. And I can watch videos about, of course, communication sciences and journalism, but I can also watch forever videos about gravity, sky, pollution, anything really. Everything interests me.
So who are exceptionally good at this?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people. One person that I do want to mention, it's not directly related to that, but it's related to David Domingo. It's Laura Arva, who's a researcher at the Tampere University in Finland, where I did a small research stay. And Laura has been working a lot on participation. She's a journalism scholar, of course, but she's worked on participation, and we did a paper together on participation. And I really love her approach to science, and she really has that same spirit as David, as, you know, we're all equal, we're trying to make the world a better place. And so, yeah, shout out to Laura. Hope you're doing good.
I'm going to add this to our link tree as well. Some links and some sources for interested listeners to go and check it out. Any other ones that you feel, I don't know, even like topic envy towards, or like are amazed at their methods or whatever?
Yeah, well, talking about audience research, I have to mention Irene Costa-Ramirez, who, you know, has been doing that for a long time and has taken this kind of same open approach to the audience, and let's take the audience seriously. And we only met once, not even sure I don't think she knows me, but I've read a lot of her research, and I'm really, yeah, really, really grateful that this research exists. And that points it also to all the people at the ECRIA, so the European Communication Research Association. They have a section, audience and reception studies, and there they have amazing people doing amazing research. The crowd there is just, yeah, those, that, that's, yeah.
I share that love. Any other shout outs?
Yeah, well, there's so many people.
I want to thank God.
No, but that's the thing. It's like literature review.
I know.
No, there's actually a few people I should mention. First of all is Geoffroy Patriarche. That connects to the audience and reception studies of ECRIA. He hates it when I call him that, but I call him my boss because he's technically my coordinator on my research project right now. I think he thinks of me more of as a colleague. We teach together, we share classes, we do research together, but I really like him. And he's also a person who takes audience studies and qualitative research really seriously, really seriously. He holds it in the highest of regards, and he's always so careful about methodology, so careful about how you construct your literature review. I think that's a great person. And then the last two person I want to mention, because then I will have gone full circle, is Florence Lecam and Fabio Pereira, two researchers who are more or less, depending on the time, based in Brussels, ULB, France, and or Brazil and Canada. Anyways, I had the chance to travel with them a lot to Brazil, to Canada, I really like their approach to research, like really materialistic. Okay, we have to get the money, we have to get people together. This is how, like, we have to, if we want to do good science, we have to get together. We have to get PhD students to confront their ID to each other. We have to get out from our desk, and we have to travel. And I love their approach to research, and they gave me this envy to travel, to meet other people, and kind of why I'm here in Tartu.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much for sparking the joy. I'm sure that there are going to be hundreds of very angry people who are like, but where's my shout out, Victor? Like, okay, we're not friends anymore. I'm not inspiring enough for you, huh? But we will deal with this risk, because our time is up. So I'm going to be the evil one who is like, no, Victor. Now I just have one more question, and it's a really simple one that we're going to ask from every guest this season. So when we think about disinfo and info disorders and everything that is wrong with the world right now, how do we fix the world?
Ha! Well, that's the thing. If there was an easy answer, we would have done it, huh?
It's please, Victor, now we need answers.
In 1 second. No, but seriously, I think that if, again, there's no easy answer, and that's the same thing. How do we fix democracy? How do we fix the internet? How do we... If there was an easy answer, seriously, we would have... I think most people mm-hmm. are good in nature and would have used it. There is none. There are a few things that we can do, and I think that's the main takeaway from my research, is take the audience seriously, take the audience into account. When you are doing, when you're devising some kind of fact-checking initiative to fight disinformation, please take the audience into account. Don't do the fact-checking that you've been doing or that looks good or that looks super professional and that's good for your ethos as a journalist, right? Do the fact-checking that will use the tone, use the whatever, the technology that people will... like and understand and want to share and want to discuss, right? It's the same thing with media literacy. Don't do the media literacy from, you know, like a some kind of standard that, you know, yeah.
Like a queen. Like a queen. Hello, peasants, I'm here to tell you about media.
Exactly, and I'm here, and you should be critical, you know, like with this really preconceived notion about what being critical is and what being informed and smart and so on. No, don't do that. Go back to the basics. What's the people, what's their need? Do they know how the media ecosystem work? Do they know how disinformation circulate, how information circulate? What's their folk theory about the media ecosystem? What's their folk theory about social media and so on? So again, same thing as with fact-checking. If you do media literacy initiative, please start with the audience. And again, in the end, I think that relates to everything that we do on the research level, but also on the political level, is please take the audience into account. Don't do it from this far away, higher up standpoint of you think you know everything and you have the right way to frame this information and so on and so on.
So thank you very much, Victor. And now I think that your day has come full circle. Public lectures, discussions with the students, an hour here in the studio with a person who can ask more than you can answer. So thank you very much, and I hope to see you soon again. And dear listeners, thank you for listening. And yeah, let's keep the audience in mind. So if you have any comments, please, I am very open to all suggestions and comments. Let me know in the comment section or via email.
Thank you very much.